Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at theopenhouse.net.au blog site.
Occasionally, while preparing Open House, we're faced with a dilemma. A guest will say something that's obviously antithetical to the Christian faith, which, as you know, is the basis for this program, even though not every guest we have shares that faith, and we'll have a decision to make as to what to do. Now, the dilemma is, if we edit the comment out, we might be seen to be censoring the guest and not presenting them fully. But then again, if we leave it in, some will think we're promoting unbiblical beliefs. We continue to welcome a variety of guests onto this program from a variety of different walks of life, and so this dilemma will come up from time to time. Recently, I recorded a wonderful conversation with well-known ABC TV personality Caroline Jones. Caroline talked about her career, her finding faith and joining the Catholic Church, and she shared deeply about the grief and doubt she experienced through losing her father. Part of Caroline's journey through grief involved her visiting a spirit medium, something she says she probably wouldn't do again, but something she says in the interview she doesn't particularly regret. Now, given the Bible's clear teaching against those things, we've actually put some verses up on the openhouse.net.au blog site for you if you'd like to study that up. That left us with a dilemma. Now, in the end, we've decided to leave Caroline's comments in and let them stimulate a discussion on the topic. Caroline shares many other things worthy of talkback too, so I'm going to look forward to your thoughts after the interview. Well, you could arguably describe her as Australian media royalty. She first stepped onto the spotlight of TV journalism in the 1960s as the first woman reporter for This Day Tonight. She went on to present programs like Four Corners, The Search for Meaning on ABC Radio, and most recently, of course, Australian Story. She's a Logie winner, a best-selling author, an officer of the Order of Australia. She's been named one of Australia's national living treasures. She spent much of her life coaxing stories out of others, so tonight let's see if we can coax a few of her own stories out of her. Her name is Caroline Jones. Welcome to Open House, Caroline.
Thank you very much, Sherrod.
Lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
First of all, we must say, you know, the cameras are rolling. This isn't making you nervous at all, is it?
I can't say that I feel nervous at the moment, no. I think you've put me beautifully at my ease. Thank you.
It's been a few years now that you've been in front of the cameras.
Just quite a few years. Rather more years than you've been alive, I think.
Isn't that you don't have to say that.
I think it's true. Well, I was at one of our universities the other day, and a young woman came towards me after I'd finished the talk to the journalism students, and I was quite delighted because she had one of my books in her hand, and I thought, oh, she's going to ask me to sign it. How lovely. So she brought the book over and she said, Caroline Jones, I'm really a bit too young to remember who you were, but she said, my grandfather would love you to sign this book for him because he tells me that he's been in love with you all his life. So that gives me an idea of how old I am. Spanning the generations. It's lovely.
Yes. Well, you've seen so much in those years. I mean, you wanted to be in journalism from a very young age, didn't you?
Yes, my grandfather was the editor of country newspapers.
And then your mother?
You've done wonderful homework. My mother wrote for the paper too. It was the Corindai Advocate, the Murrurundi Times, and the Werris Creek Express. I had a go at getting into journalism at the age of 17. I tried to get a cadetship, but I really didn't have the gumption. You know, nobody wanted to take me on because I was rather timid and shy, and I didn't look like a very handy proposition at all, so I didn't get in. So I had to wait until I was in my mid-20s before I got an opportunity, and that was in Canberra.
You've mentioned before about that shyness. Was that because of maybe being an only child?
Oh, yes, probably, and I think it's just a temperamental thing, but it was good getting into journalism because I had to overcome it. It's no good being shy as a journalist, is it?
I was an only child for the first 13 years of my life. Then my one and only brother came along and certainly did have that shyness as well. It probably develops other qualities.
I think it does. I think it develops a capacity to listen because you still want to be part of the conversation, but you don't quite know how to say much. And I do think it refines your listening skills. Hope so.
Did it do for you what it did for me, that I grew up too quickly? I was around adults all the time, so I was always engaged in adult conversation.
Perhaps that's true, but there are pluses in that as well as minuses.
Yeah, well, people think I'm 60 now and I'm 37, so yes. So that breakthrough in the 20s into journalism, what was that breakthrough?
Well, it was an opportunity. I was working in Canberra as a hotel receptionist in one of the Commonwealth hostels. And the ABC was beginning its television programs in Canberra. Radio had been going there for many years, of course. So they were recruiting two or three new people, and I was lucky enough to get one of those positions. So my training started there. And because it was a regional station, we got a chance to do everything in both radio and television. And it was a marvellous training for that reason. Mm. So I was very, very lucky.
And how did you overcome the shyness? I mean, how did you actually get the cadetship in the end?
I think I just had to grow out of it because I really wanted to do this job. So I had to overcome it, and that was good for me because out of your weakness you'll find your strength, mm-hmm. and I think that was true for me.
So out of all those years of both radio and TV, and of course you've done print as well, what have been the most memorable jobs, stories, issues that you've covered?
Mm. Well, I mean, they were exciting days when I was still working in current affairs on This Day Tonight and Four Corners. But then I came into a new phase with the Search for Meaning programs on ABC Radio National, which went for 8 years. And I really treasure those, I think because the listening audience treasured them. And we received literally thousands of letters in response to the programs, which were really the recounting of real life stories, the hard times, how you keep your faith, how you keep going. So hundreds of men and women just told these passages of their lives, and the audience responded by saying, well, this is helping me to know that I'm not alone. Mm. This is helping me to know that the search for meaning in life has some validity. I think all that storytelling gave a vocabulary in which people could think about these questions, which after all we don't, or perhaps didn't at that time, discuss very readily in Australia. So maybe that was a highlight for me. But then to be offered the chance to take part in Australian Story was a great thrill. And I'm very happy to have been there since the beginning in 1996 until now. Watch this, 2009.
And that is a brilliant TV program, isn't it, in terms of... There's the investigative aspect of it, but there's always the personal... It's got the warmth of radio for a TV program, hasn't it? It's
well,
so personal.
Yes, well, it's interesting that the inspirations for Australian Story, according to our executive producer, Deborah Fleming, were, in fact, the Search for Meaning programs, the storytelling aspect, and, on the other hand, A Big Country. I wonder if many people listening will remember A Big Country. Mm. Wonderful half-hour documentaries about many aspects of Australian life.
Again, late 80s, 90s.
So if you put those two together, you've got Australian Story, I think, perhaps. And people are enjoying them.
Still one of the highest rating TV programs for the ABC now, isn't it?
For the ABC, yes, it is.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Mm. This is Open House across the nation. Caroline Jones is with us. We're talking about her life, and I want to get to her faith in a little while, and also the book that she's written about the journey she's had with her father's death. It's called Through a Glass Darkly. Lots of lessons to be learned through there. So you're doing this program, The Search for Meaning. But before that, I think it was before that, you were leading an incredibly busy life because you were doing This Day Tonight, you were doing the TV program, then you were doing a morning program in Sydney as well, Sydney Radio. And you said that during that time, you're incredibly busy. I mean, that's a heavy workload. One of those programs alone is actually a lot of work, but both of them together is just almost unbelievable. You were busy, but you were kind of empty, and you started this spiritual search. Tell me about that.
Well, the spiritual search, I suppose, was preceded by falling to bits, because, as you said, I was working very hard, and I think I just burned out. You know, you can get overtired and do too much. Mm. And although that felt very uncomfortable at the time, I think becoming so overtired and just feeling I had come to a stop did lead me to searching for what's it all about. And that led me through a number of pathways. I started reading in the different spiritual traditions, and eventually I remembered that I had been brought up as a Christian in the Methodist and the Anglican, beautiful traditions, but I drifted away from the Christian tradition through my work. I'm not sure how that happened, because it was very real for me when I was a little child, but perhaps we go into another world of busyness, politics, see some of the evil, I suppose, in the world, and get a bit distracted by all that. So in my middle age, and I'm talking about early 40s, I suppose, yes, I did go on a search for meaning, and it eventually led me into the Catholic Church, just another of the Christian traditions.
Which is an interesting turn, given the fact that you actually had a Methodist and an Anglican upbringing.
I suppose that's right, although, I mean, I just felt completely at home. So I think that as Christians, we all should feel pretty much at home with each other, don't you?
Mm, absolutely.
Otherwise, I imagine Jesus Christ would be extremely disappointed.
Very much.
To think that we had great differences between us.
Yes.
I just happened into friendship with some Catholic families, started going to church with them. I mean, some of these things look like coincidence, don't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Or chance, but maybe it wasn't. And so, yes, in 1984, I was received into full communion with the Catholic Church. And as I say, it was all very familiar to me and felt like coming home. It also gave me more energy, more purpose, and more peace of mind, I suppose. More, would you say happiness is an odd word, but yes.
Joy.
Yes, it was a joyful feeling, and it also suggested to me a different direction in my work, and that different direction would be the Search for Meaning programs.
So when you discovered that faith, was there a particular... You met this group of Catholic nuns who really left quite an indelible impression on you.
Friends.
Okay.
Just Catholic friends.
Yeah.
Yes, and some religious sisters too. That's very true.
Yeah. You saw their life, and there was just something different about what they were doing.
Yes, that's right. There was a... It's interesting, isn't it, when you actually stop to analyse it. I think some of the things that attracted me were hospitality, fun, a kind of earthy sense of humour, an enjoyment of life, a readiness to be with each other in times of fun and or trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't sound like very religious things, do they?
Mm-hmm.
And yet I'm pretty sure they were the things that attracted me. I also happened to be going to church in a parish, St. Mary's at North Sydney. This was in the early 80s. It was a very lively parish. There was a great deal happening there. There were ministries for everything, for family, for care and concern. It was so alive. You wanted to be part of it.
Mm.
Very appealing, very attractive, very life-giving.
Mm.
So all those things, I suppose, attract one towards the faith.
Yeah. And was there a moment when you were sitting in church, or it might have been with one of the friends, where there was a distinct sense of God being more than a word, Jesus being more than an earthly figure? Was there a moment where it kind of clicked?
No, I don't think, not one of those kind of road to Damascus moments. I think it grew upon me through the people I was encountering and through the beauty of the liturgy. And it was lovely to sing the hymns again that I remembered from childhood. So it was many things that appealed to my particular sensibility and thirst at the time, perhaps, and loneliness at the time, perhaps, because I'd been so blinkered on work. So not a blinding moment, no, more of a growing into, which is better for me. I'm a bit mistrustful of sudden moments.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you've mentioned that through your books too, that being trained as a journalist, you know, one of the almost, you'd say, essential criteria is that there is an aspect of cynicism there. You've always got a doubt. You've always got a question, always got to wonder whether what you're being presented with is actually the truth.
True, yeah.
So I guess you do have to kind of grow and change and really experience these things to make sure they really are true.
Yes, maybe that's it. I hadn't quite thought of it that way before. Actually, I don't think I ever became cynical, and I hope I didn't, but I was certainly very sceptical.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reporting on politics in New South Wales when things were fairly murky. And yes, I did become extremely sceptical. But I think that's quite an intelligent way to be.
Who was it? It was Alfred Korzybski, the scientist, who actually said there are two ways to go through life. One is to believe everything. The other is to doubt everything. Both ways save us from thinking.
No, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But I think doubt is not unhealthy in one's faith. Well, we're only human. I'm only human, and I've certainly had moments of doubt.
Mm. Again, I also think of Os Guinness, who would say that doubt comes to those who believe. You have to almost start with a foundation of faith.
Mm, that's interesting.
To actually have then doubt.
That sounds right, doesn't it?
Mm. Carolyn Jones is with us on Open House tonight. Carolyn, the book that you've just released, Through a Glass Darkly, is a very personable memoir of your walking through the passing of your father in the year 2000. He was 93. Open heart surgery and the recovery process afterwards was really what probably took him in the end, wasn't it?
Mm.
His body just never fully recovered after that. It's a very open, honest memoir. And again, you go back to that girl who was very shy, now sharing what is actually very, very deep feelings and emotions. It shows where you've come from and where you've come to.
Well, yes. I really started to write as a diary to keep a record of what was happening to my father in the 56 days that I spent with him before he died, because he was quite a detailed sort of person in his thinking, and I thought, he's really going to want to know about all this. So I did it as a job for him, reporting. Well, then he didn't come through. And so I was really, grief-stricken. I was so alarmed, frightened, saddened by his ordeal, the ordeal of his suffering. And I think really that accompanying the suffering of someone you love is the worst thing that ever happens to you in your life. I think it's probably worse than your own suffering, because you sort of know what your own resources are, don't you think? But the someone you love, whether it's a child or a beloved parent, you're not quite sure. And so I think it's a terrible experience to go through.
I can't fully answer that when you were saying, do I think, because I haven't actually lost anybody that close to me yet.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
But yes. I know it's going to come.
Yes. So. Well, it does come, alas. We do lose the ones we love. And this staying there in the suffering, I think, is the greatest test of love. Because it's so easy to be together with someone you love when things are smooth, you know, it's just lovely. But when things really go wrong, there are moments when you feel, I can't bear this, I want to run away. And so I didn't until about 7 years later think that what I had written down might be worth publishing for the companionship of others who were going through a difficult time. But after Dad died, I really felt a great grief for quite a long time. I felt very disabled by that grief physically, emotionally, spiritually, because going through that time of my father's suffering, I really wondered where God was in the picture. And that kind of shaking of my faith stayed with me. One of my ways of finding out what things mean is to write. So after Dad died, I kept writing, not every day, but every now and then. And as I say, 7 years later, when I looked at it all, I thought, maybe there's something here, because I did try to write it very honestly, just write down what was happening in my head and my heart. So I thought, yes, maybe it's worth sharing. And I think probably only older readers of the Bible who like the King James Version of the Bible would recognize "through a glass darkly" from St. Paul. Oh, you know it, do
Corinthians,
you?
Yeah.
For now we see through a glass darkly.
Then we shall know fully.
Yes, but then face to face, now I know only in part, but then shall I know even as also I am known. It's slightly tortuous language, but I love it. For me, the King James Version is more poetic, more rhythmical, and "through a glass darkly" just sums up that whole experience of pain for me, because how do we know what it all means? How can you discern any meaning in such suffering as my father went through in his last 6-8 weeks of life? And I thought, what a mystery it all is, you know, what an act of faith it all is, putting one foot in front of the other, hanging in there when it's so difficult. And "through a glass darkly" just seemed to me to say it all. We don't know what it all means. We don't know how we're going to get through it, but we try and hang in there together with each other and support each other in times of trouble.
Yes.
In the faith that one day we will know.
We will know. It'll be made clear.
So that's what "Through a Glass Darkly" is about.
And where you got it from. Part of your grief in response to your father's death was also a profound sense of loneliness as well, which is purely understandable, isn't it? But I guess with the being raised as an only child, and then your mother had already passed away before now, and then your father.
Well, loneliness, I suppose that's the right word. I think aloneness. See, it came as a great shock to me, because if I had been asked even a month before Dad had the open heart surgery, what was the place of faith in my life, I would have been given a very straightforward, confident answer. I would say my faith is at the heart of my life. So it was very shocking to me to find in the course of these 8 weeks that I became very doubtful. And it was that aloneness of where is God in this? Why would my father have to go through? It's those sort of questions, very childlike questions that don't get you anywhere. But when you're in that extreme kind of stretched out state, I think you do ask questions like that. So it was aloneness Why are we alone here? Have we been abandoned here? But that all sounds crazy too, because you're in an intensive care department where all these wonderful people are doing everything they can to save your beloved.
And yet there's still that profound sense of aloneness.
There is a bit,
at the deepest sense.
And also partly because you don't actually like a lot of the things that they're doing.
Which you mention also in the book.
Yes,
you were to a good degree actually angry with some of the things.
I was angry with some of the technological intervention, even though you know it's designed for a good purpose. You know, everybody's working towards saving your father's life, but some of the treatments are pretty tough. So I was in conflict because I knew they were good people, but I didn't like what they were doing. And that puts you in a very uncomfortable situation psychologically of being in internal conflict but not expressing it.
Yes.
Because you don't want to upset the people who are looking after your father, because you want them to allow you to stay there and be his advocate.
You've been able to capture those emotions and wrap them up in language and then put them onto the page, haven't you? Because I think, you've just described in many ways what a lot of people who have gone through profound loss, the loss of a child, loss of a parent, a partner, a spouse, experience. There is anger and there is that sense of aloneness and there is that spiritual questioning. God, why? All of those things. As it goes back to, the Search for Meaning programs, there is a story now that people can actually say, I'm not alone.
That's the sort of response I'm getting to the book, and I'm pleased about that because I had to search myself to see if it was all right to publish it. I mean, it's actually it's my father's story, and I wasn't able to get his permission because he was not able to speak to me. So I really had to pray a lot about that and to think, am I entitled to tell my father's story? I knew I was entitled to tell my own part of it. So I hope that I have done the right thing by my father, and I hope that the book does sufficiently honour his courage and his integrity and his dignity, even in such a terrible situation, and indeed tell something of his own story, because he was born in 1907, and his life was very, life was very different then, and I think it's fascinating to read his memoirs. So I don't know, but insofar as I could, I've satisfied myself that it was all right to write his story, or something of his story.
And perhaps when you've presented him as a full being, not just like you said, towards the end of his life when things were very difficult.
But it is a dilemma
when
you're writing this sort of stuff, personal stuff. And, one friend said to me after reading the manuscript, what on earth would you be publishing this for? Why? It's so self-disclosing, it's so revealing. Why would you put yourself through this? And I think that I do truly believe that the most authentic gift I have to offer is my own experience, my own story. And I got that from all those years of the search for meaning, because people generously sat there with me in the radio studio and told me about their lives, warts and all, what had happened, And I got so much out of that, and the audience got so much out of it, that I came to a real conviction that that where we can truly and honestly share our own experience, that's real, and it has some value. We can help each other with that.
Nicely put. This is Open House across the nation, theopenhouse.net.au for the podcast and also the vodcast of our chat with Caroline Jones, author of many books, and the latest one being Through a Glass Darkly, which is all about her journey with her father as he was in his final moments of life, and the grief that she's experienced and the lessons, I guess, that she's been learning through that. Hard-won lessons. Let's talk a little bit more about that questioning God when you're through that moment too. Again, a very common experience for so many people. Where are you? What are you doing? How has the experience altered, changed, shaped, expanded your faith, your spirituality?
Well, it stayed shaken for quite a while. I think that other people prayed for me and visited us and kept us company, and I found that profoundly moving and tremendously helpful, because I thought, I can't pray. But to know other people were praying, it was just wonderful. It took me a long time, but eventually I came to the understanding, with the help of others, that I perhaps had set up for myself an image of God as a sort of all-powerful Father who should be able to fix everything and save us from suffering. And I think so that I'd actually put myself into a dilemma of my own making. My faith was a fairly childlike faith, with the God being the big father who could why didn't he fix everything? I think over the period of, over a long passage of time, and probably getting on for 7 years, I came to a new image of God as a more of a companion, as someone who acts for good through all these other people who have kept me company. And I include the doctors and the nurses and all of those who cared for Dad and all of those who prayed for us. So I've come out, rightly or wrongly, with a different idea of God as someone who actually was there somewhere and in the hands and the kindness and the skills and the goodness and the companionship of many other people and in the courage of my father. So it's been a big shift for me.
Yeah, we definitely do have that image very early on, don't we, if we actually are raised with Christian faith, that yes, he is the great daddy who will suddenly jump in before we just fall off the bike.
And when he doesn't.
Where is he?
Yeah, where is he? And then you're angry and then you're lost.
And yet sometimes he lets us fall off the bike because of other purposes. As you said, we still don't know.
Apparently.
Apparently, yeah.
So that's really about all I can say about that. And I would think that even at my age, I'm growing in my understanding about God and the place of God in my life. And I'd be unwise to ever say, so I've got it now.
Yeah. You spiral back a lot to the person of Jesus in the book, this person who you find is such a great role model, example for us to follow, and indeed he's more than that as well. Is there something profoundly mysterious, amazing in that sense, in the understanding that biblically we would understand Jesus as actually God in the flesh, and that on that cross we are seeing this one who says, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, where are you, God? Why have you abandoned me? That in some cases God himself has actually experienced that very same grief, that very same aloneness that you were talking about, the cry of so many people have gone through grief.
Yes, to me that reinforces the idea of the companionship of God or the companionship of Jesus Christ, because I think it is the symbol of the cross which first gave me a way to think about suffering, because in the promise of the cross we, I think, are being shown or being told not only death, the crucifixion, but also new life, the resurrection. So in the times of my life where that has I've really been able to crystallize that and see it clearly, I can see that in very, very hard experiences, which are dying experiences, killing experiences, there often are the seeds of new life in some unexpected way. And time after time, I have found that.
And maybe you're at the stage now where the sprouts are starting to come up again.
Yes, I suppose so, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other thing is, you know, healing of your sadness and your grief does come eventually. And I don't subscribe to the view that time heals grief. I think grief stays with you. Mm. I think in one sense or another, in greater or lesser degrees of intensity, I think it changes you. That you come out of an experience of grief a different person, a new person, hopefully with more compassion, certainly with more experience. I don't think you get closure. Well, I didn't get closure. I don't know what closure means, actually. I would like the presence of my mother and father to remain with me for spiritual guidance and companionship. The other thing I would like to say is that after these years, I do have beautiful memories of my parents. For a long while, I had horrible, vivid flashbacks to Dad's time in intensive care. I think I would have done well to go to counselling. I didn't. Like a lot of people, I thought, oh, heavens above, look how old I am. You know, surely I can work this out myself. Mm. I think it would have helped me to come through that flashback experience more readily, perhaps. But one way and another, I now choose beautiful images and memories, and you can do it, and for me it has worked. So now I see Dad quite vividly and quite easily, not in hospital, not suffering, but in the back garden with his funny old work shorts on and his gardening shirt and his white cotton hat, and I see him standing there at the age of 92 stretching his hand out with a little morsel of food to a circle of magpies in the back garden,
lovely.
Feeding them, you know.
Lovely.
Yeah, so lovely. That's what I've got.
Yes.
And that's a huge blessing.
Yes.
That's lovely.
Yes. Interesting that you raise that point, because you said that in many ways when your mum took her life, actually when you were 30, it was 12 years after that event that you started to even address that grief, wasn't it? It took a while then as well. There is something, and maybe it's the only child syndrome.
Well,
maybe
I think
there
it is actually, and
we'll
I think
ourselves.
You're right. I think it is, you're quite right. We think we ought to be able to solve it ourselves. And I think it's almost always a mistake. We're really not here to be just solitary. I think, why are we all here together? Surely to help each other, to reach out to each other.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, very much so. Your spiritual journey during your dad's illness and then his death and then the years since then took some interesting paths. Some Christians reading your book will be a little alarmed to find you visiting a medium and consulting.
Yeah, I was a bit alarmed myself.
What was going on there?
I think that I was really having so much trouble and feeling such a lot of pain about losing Dad, and also about, did I do everything I should have and could have for him? That was that kind of torment, because I was really his companion at that time. And I worried myself with all that stuff. And because I was still shaken in my faith and hadn't worked out, had we been abandoned, I was still going through that childlike crying out against, where was God? Then I think I wanted to know Dad was all right. And even though it's all there in the Christian teaching, you know, we are promised that we will meet up again. But no, off I went to a spiritual medium. So there you are. We will go in many different pathways when we are really, no, not we. I should talk about myself. I don't know what other people do. When I'm in trouble, sometimes I'll look in odd places. But, you know, my experience in going to the spirit medium was not an unwholesome experience. Perhaps I was very fortunate to encounter a person whose integrity I really wouldn't doubt. And whether what it all means, I still don't know. But maybe I was just looking for a reassuring message in some language other than the language of my church, which I had become a bit uncertain about. And so off I went. And as I say, I was very fortunate to go to a woman who, I don't know what that skill is or facility or whatever you'd call it, but I don't believe that I was being tricked by someone who was lacking in integrity. I believe that the person with whom I spent an afternoon either had great compassion or perhaps there are ways of being in touch with the spirituality of those who've gone. I mean, I simply don't know. Yeah. All I know is it gave me a pleasing reassurance that I hadn't lost my mother and father forever, that they were somewhere safe, that they were available to accompany me. Now, when I ask the same questions to my Christian friends, I actually get a very similar answer. And after I'd been to the spirit medium, I asked some of my friends in the church, do you believe that our parents are caring for us somehow, that they're still around somehow? Oh, yes. You know? So I was really interested that from these two different sources, I was getting the same message couched in different language.
Because some would, you know, feel that there is prescriptions against consulting spirit mediums in both the Old and New Testaments, etc. And feeling a certain sense of anxiety about that.
They probably are. Well, I probably wouldn't do it now. But I also don't want to denigrate someone who says that she's a spirit medium who is certainly seeking to help anyone who comes to console. I don't want to denigrate, because I think there's an awful lot we don't know about how the human mind works and how this, you know, how our spiritual selves work. I don't want to criticise or denigrate.
Well, that would actually put you at odds quite a bit with your church, though, wouldn't it?
What, going to a spirit medium?
Yes.
Well, I don't know. No one's taken me to task over it. I think people in the church have got compassion, and they know that sometimes you go a bit off the rails and you can get a bit desperate. I don't know. Maybe I did horrify some church people. If so, they haven't said it to me.
You haven't got the nasty
letters. Perhaps they haven't got around to it yet.
Right. Haven't got to that particular chapter.
No.
So looking back over these years, there's been Australian Story, there's been The Search for Meaning, there's been TV, radio, everything else in between, books. Anything left?
I don't think there's much left, but I do thank you for your interest in my work and in my book. And I thank you for your quality of listening. And I thank you for having me as a guest on your program.
Well, I thank you for your kindness. You too. Carolyn Jones.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit theopenhouse.net.au.